The best part of holiday gifting? Giving them something they'll use all year. During December deal drops at Lowe's, save $40 on select Craftsman V20 tools, now just $59. Plus, all rewards members get free standard shipping. Shop new December deal drops every week this month. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 12/10. While supplies last, free shipping excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Subject to change. Visit Lowe's.com/shipping terms for details.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we are tackling a single listener stack of sources, and it's a collection that gives you whiplash, frankly.
It really does.
So we're going to perform a kind of intellectual shortcut. We are jumping from, you know, allegations of war crimes at the very highest levels of the Pentagon, all the way to a surprisingly resilient corporate earnings season.
Yeah, one that seems totally determined to just ignore all the political chaos. It's a real study in institutional stress tests.
Right.
Our mission today is to really pull out the key nuggets from these very different fields. We have to understand the systemic breakdown that's implied when powerful figures just circumvent norms.
Whether that's in military command or, say, judicial appointments.
Exactly. And then we have to contrast that with the signals corporate America is sending about, you know, economic stability heading into 2026.
That's the core tension. And I mean, we have to start with the most dramatic and pretty disturbing headline in the sources.
Mm-hmm.
This all centers on Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth and a military operation back in September. Okay, let's unpack this. The Washington Post reported a specific incident,
right,
where Hegseth allegedly told Admiral Frank Bradley to, and this is a quote, kill everybody during an attack on what were apparently unarmed boats.
And this is where the legal gravity just hits you immediately.
Yeah.
The reporting suggests the first assault, it left two survivors.
Okay.
And then, following Hegseth's alleged command, Bradley ordered a second volley, specifically targeting those two people. Who were then killed. And if that's true, the sources are. I mean, they couldn't be clearer.
Mm-hmm.
Executing shipwrecked survivors or anyone who has surrendered is a direct, undeniable violation of the Geneva Conventions.
It's essentially giving no quarter. And the expert legal commentary we have in our sources, it gives zero wiggle room on this. We have former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta on the record.
What did he say?
He said, I don't think there's any trusting that that's a war crime if it happened in that way.
And that sentiment is just echoed everywhere. Ryan Goodman, the former general counsel at the DOD, he points out that the Pentagon's own law of war manual.
Their own manual?
Their own manual, yeah. It explicitly lists attacking shipwreck survivors as a textbook example of an illegal order. An order that, you know, by military procedure, service members are supposed to refuse.
The implication there is enormous.
It is. We're talking about allegations of an order from the absolute highest civilian level that is flagrantly illegal.
So what has the administration's response been? The source material calls it dancing around the facts.
Which is putting it mildly. It's been chaotic. Hmm. First, Hegseth complimented the admiral. Then he called the whole story fake news.
And now
he's trying to throw Bradley under the bus, as they say, suggesting the second volley was all the admiral's call, independently.
This attempt to shift blame, it really points to a systemic problem, right?
Yeah.
Accountability is being dodged, and the chain of command seems to be destabilized from the very top.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And when Donald Trump was asked about it, he admitted he agreed with the first military assault.
Okay.
But didn't support the second one that killed the survivors. So this just confirms that Hegseth may be acting as a kind of rogue agent, you know, making his own law.
It reminds me of that bizarre pep talk he gave earlier this year.
Exactly. And the political fallout is growing. This isn't just about Hegseth's legal fate anymore. It's about the security implications of his behavior.
Right. Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona, a former astronaut and military guy, he's been really forceful. He called Hegseth's conduct embarrassing and said he runs around like a 12-year-old playing army.
And the context for that criticism is so important. Kelly highlighted that Hegseth is in the National Command Authority for nuclear weapons.
Which is terrifying.
It is. When you have a figure who allegedly shows this,
mm-hmm,
this kind of instability, this willingness to bypass the law, it raises fundamental questions about his judgment in a real crisis.
And that's why we're seeing investigations now.
That's why. Both the Senate and House Armed Services Committees have launched full investigations. It's a perfect example of the Streisand effect.
Okay, so this chaos in the military chain of command, it leads us right into the second major theme from the sources. this pattern of operating outside of, let's call it, normal order.
Mm-hmm. In political and judicial appointments.
Exactly. Let's look at this fascinating and honestly highly technical saga of Alina Haba. She was just disqualified as the U.S. attorney in New Jersey.
This is a wild one. It's truly a high-stakes legal shell game, all designed to bypass the Senate.
So set the stage for us.
Okay, so Haba was nominated, but she couldn't get confirmed because the New Jersey Democrats withheld their blue slips, which is a custom that lets them veto nominations.
Right.
So she served as interim U.S. attorney. But there's a law, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, that says after 120 days with no confirmation, the job automatically goes to the top career prosecutor, in this case, Desiree Grace.
So Grace takes over, as she's supposed to, and that's when Attorney General Pam Bondi attempts this incredibly sophisticated maneuver to get around the law.
It was something else. Bondi first fired Grace.
Fired her.
Then she yanked Haba's nomination. And then, in this really rapid-fire sequence, she installed Haba as the first assistant U.S. attorney and then immediately elevated her to acting U.S. attorney.
The goal being to reset the clock and put Haba back in charge without any Senate approval.
Exactly. They thought they'd found a clever little loophole.
But a federal appeals panel, and it's worth noting, this included two George W. Bush appointees. They shut it down cold. What was the ruling?
The court basically said the law isn't that easy to get around. It states that only the first assistant who was already in the role when the vacancy happens can be elevated.
Ah, so Haba was shoehorned in after the fact.
Precisely. After the 120-day limit had already passed. So the court ruled she was unqualified, unauthorized, and she lacked the authority to even initiate cases.
And the immediate real-world cost of this is, it's huge. We saw a similar thing with Lindsey Halligan in Virginia, right?
We did. And that led to cases being dismissed, including these major indictments against figures like James Comey and Letitia James.
Wow.
The sources say the administration is thinking about re-indicting both of them. But this whole pattern has created what John Day, the president of the American College of Trial Lawyers, he called it a procedural morass.
It sounds like it.
The uncertainty is just. It's deeply alarming.
Yeah.
Because when the administration chooses to act like, and this is his quote, toddlers in charge, the integrity of the whole justice system is undermined.
So if that's the chaos in the judicial and military worlds, let's turn to how that instability is playing out on the political map.
Gerrymandering.
Specifically, the high-stakes push in Indiana. Trump is focused on turning the state's 7 Republican, 2 Democrat delegation into a perfect 9R delegation.
And the map they've unveiled is just... It's extraordinarily aggressive. They're taking Indianapolis's bluest district, INO7, which is currently D+21.
The very safe Democratic seat.
Very safe. And they're chopping into 4 separate districts. The goal isn't just to dilute the vote. It's to make the bluest district that's left R+10. It's a targeted effort to wipe out every single Democratic seat.
And State House Speaker Todd Houston, he apparently has the votes to push it through. But here's the fascinating part, right? The Republican-dominated state Senate is pushing back.
Yeah, they're resisting Trump's pressure, which you have to ask, why fight a sure thing?
So why?
It comes down to local survival instincts. State senators are worried they'll be thrown out on their ear by moderate voters if they go along with what they see as a radical stunt.
So it's a fracture line within the GOP itself.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's not about policy. It's about cultural optics and, you know, political survival.
And we have a specific example of that resistance, State Senator Michael Bochek. A Republican. He's a firm no vote.
Right. And his reasoning is really revealing.
Yeah.
He cited Trump's recent use of the word retarded as a slur. He said that specific language was a bridge too far.
So he's not resisting based on the map itself.
Not at all. He's resisting based on the toxicity of the national brand that's pressuring him to pass it. The vote is set for a special session on December 8th. And if the state Senate holds firm, I mean, it shows that even in these supermajorities, there are limits.
Let's move quickly from that to another headline that always gets attention, Donald Trump's health. We have sources talking about his recent preventative MRI at Walter Reed.
Yeah, and the official results say normal, but the skepticism from medical experts in the source material is pretty much universal. Dr. Jonathan Reiner, who is Dick Cheney's longtime cardiologist,
right.
He said flatly that the letter doesn't pass the smell test.
So why so much skepticism if the official letter says everything's normal?
Because, as Dr. Reiner and others explain, there really is no preventative cardiac MRI. It's just not a standard routine test for an 80-year-old man.
So it's not like getting a regular checkup.
Yes.
Not at all. Advanced imaging like that is typically only ordered when there's a reason, a clinical event, a weird symptom, a bad result on an earlier test.
Yeah.
So calling it preventative just suggests they're hiding the real reason for the test.
The vagueness is the point.
The vagueness is the political shield.
Okay, let's shift gears and look ahead. If that's the current political landscape, what are the stress tests coming up on the calendar before the full 2026 cycle really heats up?
We have a few early House special elections to watch. TX18 has a runoff on January 31st. It's Dem versus Dem, so not that exciting politically. But it highlights a problem for Governor Greg Abbott. That seat's been vacant for almost a year. It's a black mark on his administration's efficiency.
Okay, what else is interesting?
NJ11. The primary is February 5th. It's a D+5 seat, and the Democrats have 13 candidates fighting for it.
13? Wow.
Yeah, and if the eventual Democratic winner takes the general election by a really big margin, that's going to be an early, strong signal of some serious national headwinds for the GOP.
And then there's Marjorie Taylor Greene's seat.
Then there's GA14. Her resignation isn't official until January 5th, which is, you know, just 2 days after she qualifies for her lifetime pension and health care.
A detail, I'm sure, is just a coincidence.
Of course. The district is R+19, so it's safe. But if the Republican candidate only wins that special election by, say, single digits, that would be the real harbinger of trouble for the party.
For the real politics junkies, you have to mark March 3rd on the calendar. Texas AG Ken Paxton is running for Senate.
Yeah, and he's facing so much legal trouble and internal party dissent. The analysis suggests that if he actually gets the nomination, he might be vulnerable enough to lose that seat, which is a huge concern for Republicans.
But you're saying the race with the biggest long-term impact is in Wisconsin?
Without a doubt. The state Supreme Court election on April 7th, it's an open seat, technically nonpartisan, but the stakes just could not be higher.
So explain for our listeners why this one court race is so critical.
It's all about control. If the Democrats win this seat, they secure a 5-2 liberal majority on the court.
And with that majority, they could. What?
They could dictate all future legislative maps in the state, the maps that will govern politics there for the next decade. Plus, they control rulings on election rules, abortion laws, you name it. For a swing state like Wisconsin, that 5-2 majority is absolutely critical for any potential 2028 presidential fight.
And the Republican candidate, Maria Lazar, is already signaling how tough this is.
She is. She is actively trying to distance herself from Trump. She said, quote, "I am through and through and all the way a judge, not a politician."
That's not exactly hugging the standard bearer close.
Not even close. It just shows you how hard it is to win those nonpartisan races when the national party's brand is so volatile.
Okay. We have detailed institutional breakdown, political chaos, I mean, at every level. And now for our final shift, we dive into the economic side of things.
Right. The Q3 S&P 500 earnings.
The big question is, does any of this political chaos even register on the corporate level?
The answer, astonishingly, is no. The headline is that corporate fundamentals are still incredibly firm, just showing profound resilience.
What are the numbers?
The Q3 blended earnings growth rate is nearly 17% year over year. And what's crucial is that that's more than double what analysts originally projected.
And that's expected to continue.
It is. They're forecasting strong growth, close to 14%, to persist right into 2026.
So let's break that down. Where is that leadership coming from?
Well, predictably, technology is leading the charge. A lot of that is the AI boom. But financials and industrials are also showing some surprising strength.
And what's lagging?
The traditionally defensive sectors, so energy and consumer staples.
So the sources also talk about these historic beat rates this quarter. The earnings beat rate is almost 83%.
And the revenue beat rate is over 78%. That level of outperformance is just, it's tremendous. But we do need to talk about this earnings hook concept.
Okay, explain that.
So in the first half of the year, Q1 and Q2, the beat rates were high. But it was partly because analysts had been lowering their estimates beforehand.
So companies were just clearing a lowered bar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But for Q3 and what we're seeing for Q4, the estimates were either flat or even rising a little bit before the reports came out. That means this current strong beat rate, it's high quality performance, it's real pricing power, real efficiency.
So solid fundamentals, high quality beats. And yet the sources note that investors are being, quote, stingy. They're not rewarding these massive beats.
Right, but they are severely punishing any misses.
So why the hesitation? Why isn't the market fully celebrating this strength?
That is the big disconnect. I think investors are showing a lot of anxiety. They're hedging. They see the earnings strength, but they're also very wary of all the external factors.
Geopolitical instability, interest rates.
And frankly, the administrative and political chaos we spent the last, 12 minutes detailing. The bull case for 2026 really hinges on this profit growth broadening out across the whole S&P 500, not just staying in a few big tech names.
We have covered an incredible range today from, serious allegations of war crimes and systemic attempts to get around the law, through pivotal state elections, and finally to record high earnings.
Our sources clearly show these administrative structures are being broken by design across the board. And yet you have this corporate economic engine that is just running efficiently, posting resilient results, almost totally disconnected from the instability in Washington.
So here is the final provocative thought we want to leave you with. Given that corporate fundamentals seem so strong and forward earnings are still rising, does the market's current resilience represent a calculated, rational hedge against all this chaos? Or is it maybe a fundamental blind spot, a refusal to see the widespread instability and this rejection of normal order that we're seeing everywhere else? What stands out to you?
A lot to think about there.
Thanks for diving deep with us.
Until next time.